It's Labor Day. H-Town, live from the Mokarem Injury Lawyer Studios. Here's Payne and Pendergast.
I asked our listeners to check in with us if they're up with us this morning. Payne and Pendergast with you. We are live in studio this morning. It appears, Seth, that the two main industries or vocations, lines of work, transportation and retail, a lot of them are up early today.
That makes sense.
Yep. Yeah. Heading in, the railroad doesn't stop. So that's a railroad worker. That's true. Working for the airlines in El Salvador, airline workers work all holidays. True. I know that. City of Houston, tier one worker on the way to work, making sure our drinking water infrastructure is intact.
Oh, that's important.
Yes.
People like their drinking water.
Like the drinking water. Yeah. Hell yeah.
I love that people are listening from El Salvador, or at least one person. We get so many. I love the service members that are able to listen from all. We get checked.
That's the best.
We got a lot of people listening in Germany at any given time.
Yes.
I think we got a lot of people listening in the Middle East, but we never know exactly how many. It's very hard to figure out. And I would imagine there's a lot of service people. There's service men and women working today.
I would think so too. Yeah, I hope so.
I would imagine.
I hope so. National Defense takes the day off. Chemical engineer here. On my way to the plant for a startup that we're 3 years behind on. Oh, wow.
Oh, my gosh.
Have worked all weekend. I'm wearing clothes that my wife hasn't washed in a week. Oh, sir, you must stink right now. We appreciate you listening.
Yeah, but the thing about going to work at the refinery is it's probably, I'm sure the BO level is pretty high at any given time.
And a high tolerance for it.
A lot of sweatiness out there, yeah. So he probably doesn't, it's not like he's going into a PTA meeting or something wearing stinky clothes.
That's true. By the way, it's my dog's birthday. Happy birthday, Rocket. Happy birthday, Rocket, yeah.
Seven happy birthdays. He's aging rapidly, Rocket is.
I will, that's right. I'll tell you what I got. We'll get to the Texans here. What Amy and I got sucked into yesterday watching on TV before we went over to her parents' house for a barbecue on Sunday morning. We're just flipping around. It was these dogs doing obstacle courses.
Oh, yeah.
Have you watched that? I'd never watched this before. They are so well trained, and the slalom that they do.
Yeah, it's amazing how they. Yeah,
the slalom is incredible.
It's like they don't even lose any speed.
No.
They're still running incredibly fast from point A to point B, but going through all those cones are set up like a foot apart from each other.
Dude, and I was proud of myself. Like by maybe like the third or fourth dog, I had a really good gauge on just what their finishing time was going to be.
So you're going to start gambling
on
this.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. I will. I'm going to. Yes. If I can't, I can find it. Yes. So there you go. All right. Texans debuts this weekend. The one I am most excited for, because I feel like it encompasses most of the positional debuts on that side of the ball, Seth. Mm-hmm. Nick Cayley, offensive coordinator. It's not even a player I'm most excited to see. I am excited to see A, what a Nick Cayley offense entails, and B, what kind of chess player he is when it comes to going against his old team on Sunday.
This is what I'm bracing myself for now, and everybody else has to brace themselves for this as well. They are very old school in their methodology when it comes to believing and being committed to running the ball. At least so far it seems that way.
Mm-hmm.
And that includes whether or not it's going well in the first half. That it's going to be a volume rushing attack, and that you hope by the second half the dam breaks and it starts to pay dividends. So I'm going to be patient. I'm not going to have any tweets in the first half saying that they got to fire Nick Cayley or anything. I'll save that for Monday. But yeah. Now but then also though, and I will be, even if the run game isn't working, I hope that it's working because the Rams realize they got to commit to stopping the run, and that it opens up some play action. So I will weather some rushing attempts that don't look so hot as long as two things happen. One, it's opening up the play action a little bit, and two, that it's as long as it's. Oh, it's not looking great, but they're getting 2 or 3 yards at a clip.
Mm-hmm.
That's still an improvement over last year.
Oh, yeah.
Because last year it was they're getting tackled for a loss when they run on first down.
Yes.
So just keeping the ball moving forward incrementally and steadily is progress over last year.
Second and six is your friend. You know?
Second
and six is your friend. That's how I feel about Sunday.
When we add into all of that with Nick Cayley, the dynamic that, Joe Mixon's not going to be out there. And I cannot suggest strongly enough, everybody, good people, working or not working on Labor Day. Mm-hmm. Don't watch Joe Mixon highlights. Because it's because I think Nick Chubb looks way better than I was afraid he was going to look, and I think that you can get work done with Nick Chubb. But man, I haven't seen anything out of Nick Chubb in training camp that looks like Joe Mixon during the regular season last year in terms of explosiveness and speed. So when I want to try to get myself excited about the running backs, I'm thinking about Woody Marks. And I think that Woody Marks might end up playing a lot more than I would have thought maybe a month ago or so. Because the biggest thing that keeps rookies off the field is that coaches are worried that they're going to screw it up, that they just can't trust them. Woody Marks so far, by virtue of how good he is in pass protection, leads me to believe that he's probably doing a lot of the other stuff right mentally and in terms of his assignments and his route running and everything else like that. Because pass protection is usually the last thing that comes along with rookie running backs. Yep. So I think Woody Marks is going to be a much bigger part of the game plan than hopefully even the Rams think, and that they can spring him on him a little bit.
He is 100% going to be, and I've been saying this since he's been running the ball in these preseason games, and you can see the pop that he runs with. Is that just do the math. Nick Chubb is not designed right now to be a guy who's touching the ball 20, 22 times a game. Damian Pierce is a guy that they didn't trust last year at the end of the year when he was healthy. He hasn't done anything in training camp yet or in the preseason. He had seven carries for 17 yards in that one preseason game he played in. So I would love for Damian Pierce to round back into form and look like he did in 2022, but I don't know that we can bank on that. Woody Marks is healthy. To your point, Seth, he can be trusted. He's versatile. Like, if you want to throw the ball to him, he can catch. If you want to run the ball with him, I think we saw enough in the preseason to show you that he runs with some quickness, some burst, and some physicality. I think Woody Marks, if they put the over-under on touches for Woody Marks on Sunday at 10.5, I'd take the over. I think he's going to touch the ball a bunch of times on Sunday.
The thing that makes me a little bit nervous about Damian Pierce is that some of the, you know, they're running between the tackles a lot more, at least they did this preseason compared to last preseason. And it looks good, and they're getting positive yardage. But the types of runs that they've been calling a lot, they've run a lot of duo, which is where the offensive linemen just double-team the defensive tackles up, you know, try to get push on the line of scrimmage there. But then the running back has to read the linebacker and make his cut based off of where the linebackers are. And it's like this, like Damian just doesn't have the same vision as Nick Chubb or Joe Mixon or those guys. So it is still a little bit more muddled of a look than some of just the old school conventional powers and counters and things like that. So I don't know. That's where Kaylee's play calling comes in. I think the play calling is going to need to be a little bit different for Damian Pierce than it does for Joe Mixon.
Yeah, I think so too. I am excited to see Nick Chubb in his debut. I think almost by default, he's going to be a big part of what they want to do on Sunday. I'm anxious to see if the good that we saw in the one preseason game he played in, the one drive he played, I guess played in one or two drives in that second preseason game against Carolina, it looked good. It looked good with Nick Chubb. So I'm looking forward to seeing him on Sunday.
Yeah, for all of that stuff that we talked about in terms of just keeping the sticks moving and keeping the line of scrimmage progressing, I think he looks good there. It's going to have to be – this is why it's going to be a real good test for Nick Kaylee, is that you just can't count on Joe Mixon popping off an 80-yard run to really flip the table in the game. It's going to have to be steady and methodical. And then the things that flip the scripts hopefully are some deep play action shots.
Yeah, that'd be good. That would be good. We'll get some clarity, I would assume, on C.J. Gardner-Johnson tomorrow, probably. I think they're tomorrow they're off.
Wednesday.
They are practicing today. Wednesday's the first injury report, right?
Yeah.
So we'll get some clarity there. Although we may get a report as to whether or not he's practicing today. I know D'Amico's meeting with the media today. I think they're practicing today.
Yeah, that's true. If he's 100, if we get some kind of a report today, then I'd say that's really good news because it probably means that he's going to be probable at least, and that they're ready to go. We haven't heard any scuttlebutt or anything that would suggest that it's worse than feared or what have you. But we also haven't gotten any positive news about it.
No.
So Texans play it close to the vest, which I appreciate this time of year.
He was at the season premiere last week on Thursday. C.J. Gardner-Johnson was, and I say that because some of the injured guys were not there. Joe Mixon was not there at the season premiere on Thursday. So and I was at the table next to C.J. Gardner-Johnson, and he looked to be in very good spirits at the table. He was holding court at the table. Big personality. So Didn't look like somebody who'd be depressed over the fact that he'd be missing the season opener in his Texans debut.
Did you say Erin Kapner was sitting at his table?
She was sitting at our table.
Oh, okay.
She was looking over at his table at him and commented on his Super Bowl ring. She's like, wow.
Oh, that's right.
That is a really big ring that C.J. Gardner, that player has on over there. I said, well, that's C.J. Gardner-Johnson, and he was on the Eagles last year, so he's showing off his Super Bowl ring.
I think, honestly, it's weird because it feels like some of the discussion around C.J. Gardner-Johnson and his injury, there hasn't been nearly the amount of hand-wringing, seemingly, as there has been over Joe Mixon's injury. And I wonder if part of it is that C.J. Gardner-Johnson still feels like found money. That he wasn't a huge part of your offseason plans until all of a sudden he was. But the difference it makes, if you're Matt Stafford, a veteran quarterback who's dealing with a herniated disc, and you think about throwing into that secondary when you've already got a bunch of ball hawks back there, but you add C.J. Gardner-Johnson to the mix to the point where you've got four spots in the secondary, where four areas of the secondary that you got to have a little bit of trepidation when you're throwing.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, MJ Stewart doesn't provide that same level of angst for a quarterback that C.J. Gardner-Johnson does. I mean, it's a huge deal in terms of this defense really building on what they did last year and adding on to it. Like, yes, they were second in the league in interceptions last year. They can be more menacing on a down-by-down basis to an extreme degree just with the presence of C.J. Gardner-Johnson.
It's probably – found money is a good way to put it. I would guess, you know, a lot of times the angst comes from people who aren't at practice and things like that. It's just your word.
Yeah.
And Joe Mixon, there is a year's worth of footage that makes the point that you were making 5 minutes ago, which is – a lot of those yards, those 1,000 yards he got last year was because he's Joe Mixon, not because the scheme was doing anything to help him out. Most of the Texan fans don't even know what C.J. Gardner-Johnson looks like in a Texans uniform. He was there for the first week and a half of training camp and then got hurt at the Greenbrier, where almost nobody is except for me, you, and a few other people. So they just don't know what it looks like right now with C.J. Gardner-Johnson.
Right, yeah, and with Joe Mixon, too, it's the mystery of him just not even being out there at practice or being around and what the heck is actually going on with him. And you're right. I mean, when you step back and look at it objectively, if you're handicapping the Texans from the outside looking in, you're looking at the offense and you're thinking, well, last year the rushing numbers actually look a lot better than they actually were just because Joe Mixon had all those heroic long gains or what have you. But that you remove him from last year's offense, and, man, it's really, really bad.
Yeah.
It's just an absolute disaster.
Dude, not just the long ones, but even Joe Mixon, when there'd be just clutter in front of him, and he would just break it to the outside and go get you 12 yards.
Yeah.
When the play is blocked for -3 yards, you know?
That's one of the things I'm interested in seeing when he comes back and how it's a reflection on Nick Caley, perhaps, is that there were also, though, a lot of times where he bounced it outside. Mixon bounced it outside when he should have just followed the blocking and run the play as executed, which I kind of gave him a pass on it because he so rarely had a good look from the blocking in front of him that I think he just kind of got into freelance mode. I would hope this year that there's more clarity and he feels more comfortable just hitting the play as it's called and designed more often. Because I think there were, especially as the season went on, it just seems there were some glaring examples where you're like, why did you bounce that out? Like, it was an easy 5 yards. You don't have to hit a home run every single time. But I think he might have felt like he had to hit a home run every single time.
Is it too easy an answer to say the offensive line debut that we're most looking forward to is Ariante Ursary? Is that just too easy an answer right now?
I don't think it's too easy. I think that we've talked about Ariante Ursary as a promising young offensive tackle and how good he's looked so far, and he played his way into a starting position. Because remember, the day that Cam Robinson got injured, Cam Robinson was running with the twos, and the twos came out with the first group, and he got injured. It wasn't like, so Ariante Ursary was going to be running with the ones that day. I think that it's him versus Jared Verse. It's Ariante versus Jared Verse. And one of the things that Ariante Ursary, I think, still needs to work at is there's times where he just lets guys get into his body too much. And in college, he's such a big guy that he could kind of absorb the power rush. And, because he's such a monster, it didn't hurt them as much. Jared Verse is an extreme.
Yeah.
Extreme. He's an outlier.
Welcome
in terms
to the
of
NFL,
strength.
Kid.
Yeah. I mean, Tron Armstead, usually offensive linemen don't worry too much about bull rushes. Tron Armstead, when he retired this year and was asked on a podcast, I think he was on Bustin' with the Boys, was asked like one of the reasons he wouldn't come back. And he said, Jared Verse, man, I don't need to be seeing that bull rush again. I don't want to see that bull rush ever again.
Man.
So, and we've seen, look, yes, Will Anderson has a good, he's got a lot of power. It's not the same as Jared Verse. Jared Verse is an extreme outlier. So, Ursary's got a big test in that regard right off the bat in week one.
Okay. So, I can get Jared Verse total sacks, Seth, at 7.5 sacks this season.
Yeah. I would take the over on that.
I would say that's what I'm saying. He only had 4.5 last year, but I know you've done some extensive film work on him because he's the Texans' opponent in week one, as you just pointed out. And there were a lot of opportunities for him to get the quarterback down that he just got a little.
He was a lot like Will Anderson, where he was really good at getting close to the quarterback, but it was finishing the rush and separating at the top of his rush that he was just still very raw.
Yeah.
And all the reports are that he's kind of like, I don't want to say he's like Will Anderson, but he's got a really good work ethic. He's worked at it. He knows what the issue was. And I think that he likely ends up finishing a lot of those sacks that he didn't last year. And that's where you look. If you look at the progression of most really good pass rushers in the NFL, the majority of them are in the single-digit sacks their first year. And then usually in the second year, they kind of take off, or sometimes it's not until the third year. But it's more the exception when a guy gets double-digit sacks in his rookie year. They usually just they have to refine, and then they build on it. So, I think he's definitely going to get if he does, I'll be surprised if he doesn't get more than 7.5.
I'm excited for Arianti Ursary. I'm intrigued by Jake Andrews because he has started one game in his NFL career, and they're banking on him to be the center for this offensive line.
Yeah.
And I mean, this is one of those things that if this works, like, this is one of those things, like, they appear, the Texans right now, to be the team that, like, well, we're smarter than everybody else when it comes to Jake Andrews. Because the league has given their verdict on Jake Andrews. He was available for anybody to pick up. He started one game. He's played in 10 games in, what, like 2 years, 3 years, whatever it is. He's been in the NFL. And they, an offensive line that is in a complete rebuild mode right now, is entrusting the center position, the supremely important position of center, to a guy with one start. And if it ends up that he's average, which I would sign up for today, that Jake Andrews is an average NFL center, that is a massive win for Nick Caserio and Nick Cayley and D'Amico Ryans.
And he's going to be seeing Puna Ford a whole lot, which is, I can't even remember who Puna Ford was playing for last year, but he had a really good game versus the Texans. It was the Chargers, I believe. And Puna Ford was one of the few guys that I was really impressed with in that game. And he's going to be the nose tackle. So right off the bat, he's got Puna Ford. He's got Braden Fisk, the other rookie, the Jared Verse teammate from college that was also very good last year. The interior offensive line, the sum total of them, and the fact that you're taking, hey, look, Laken Tomlinson is past his prime. He's been very steady and solid throughout his career, but he's going into his 11th year. You've got Ed Ingram at right guard, who was benched by the Vikings last year, and then you've got Andrews at center, who is just a classic, as of right now, a journeyman type in the NFL. And, on paper, it doesn't look great. It really needs to be one of those situations where the sum is greater than just the, it's a greater than the sum of its parts,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah,
you
got to
have the synergy of guys working together.
Yep.
And that's where it keeps me from, I just can't sit here and act like this is going to be an awesome offensive line. But there are a lot of NFL offensive lines that are good enough with not a lot of marquee names on it just because they play well together and they're well coached. And I think they can be that. They can be a solid offensive line with these guys.
All right. So we'll get into more Texan debuts a little later in the show. We were pretty offense heavy. We'll look over at the defense maybe a little bit later on in the program. All right, let's do some acknowledgments here. Acknowledge me. We do it. Ooh, down a little bit. There we go. I feel like Roman Reigns is sitting in my lap. That's the music right there for Acknowledge Me. We do it every Monday at about 7:20. Big performances from over the weekend, and we acknowledge them. I will say a name. Mitchell will then
acknowledge me.
That, and we are off to the races. Real quick, couple of texts. I'm up with you guys. I'm in law enforcement listening to you guys. Appreciate y'all working. Gabe, you know what? I'm going to acknowledge Gabe right now.
Acknowledge
me. Law enforcement up listening to us. That's good, man. Keeping us safe. Listening in Kerrville, waiting in line at Mary's Tacos. Anyone who's been here knows. So I guess Mary's, Mary's Tacos.
Acknowledge me.
Mary's Tacos in Kerrville.
Mary's Tacos in Kerrville.
In Kerrville, yeah, man. Yeah,
I've got a note somewhere on my phone for places to try in various places around Texas.
There you go. Yeah. Put it in there, man. Put it in there. Listener says it's good. All right, Spencer Arrighetti.
Acknowledge me.
And Christian Javier.
Acknowledge me.
I hope to add Luis Garcia to that list. We don't acknowledge Luis Garcia yet. But those two, Seth, on Friday and Saturday, pitched a combined 12 and a third. It's 12.1 on the box score. 12 and a third innings pitched. One hit. The only hit was the home run that Arrighetti gave up. So one earned run. 8 walks, which needs to be worked on a little bit. And then 14 strikeouts in 12 and a third innings between the two guys. Arrighetti had 8 in 6 and a third. Javier had 6 in 6 innings. So that was good to see. They were getting some guys to strike out. If these two guys just get a little bit better command, look out, because you've got Hunter, you've got Framber Valdez, and you know, I don't know what Jason Alexander is going to be, if the league's going to catch up with Jason Alexander at some point. His last start wasn't great, but it was okay. It's good enough to win. But boy, if you're getting Arrighetti back at what he's been and Christian Javier back, it was so cool just to look at a box score with Javier pitching 6 innings with no hits next to his name.
Without Luis Garcia coming back until today, obviously, until we don't know exactly what we're going to get out of Luis Garcia, I had always said that if two of those three guys coming back from the IL look like a good version of themselves, I'm going to be happy with that. So as long as Arrighetti and Javier continue to look like they have recently, I feel like I'm already ahead of the curve because you add Jason Alexander to it. So then you got 5 starting pitchers right there going into the playoffs, mm-hmm. and then Luis Garcia is a bonus on top of that.
Yep.
Then we start talking piggyback starts and whatnot in the mm-hmm. playoffs. We got too many good starting pitchers, which is impossible, obviously,
don't
especially when the offense can't score more than 0.7 runs per game. Yeah,
I don't know. It's only been 1 or 2 good starts for these.
John,
guys.
We got too many good starting pitchers.
Don't
what are we going to do?
It.
What
don't
are we going to do about it?
I'm fearful. Yeah, But those two starts on Friday and Saturday, really good to see by both those guys, for sure. All right, a few college football ones here. We had a lot of college football over the weekend. Garrett Neusmeyer.
Acknowledge me.
Starting quarterback for LSU who went into Clemson and won, and he was able to overcome his fat face to engineer a win over Clemson in Death Valley. The Clemson version of Death Valley. That was a little battle I didn't realize was going on between these two schools. Not only are they both named the Tigers, but I mean, I knew this, but I didn't realize it was such a big deal between the two schools. Like, hey, we're Death Valley. No, we're Death Valley. No, actually, neither of you are technically Death Valley. Death Valley's in California.
Well, there's something about Louisiana in general, because with the Saints versus, they got that whole Houdat thing where they argue with the
Cincinnati.
With the Bengals,
yeah. Yeah, yeah, Cincinnati says.
Which I don't know. I've never bought it from Cincinnati. The Houdat, Houday, anything like that sounds way more Louisiana than
way
it does Cincinnati.
More. Although Cincinnati, underrated in its ruralness.
Underrated in its, yeah, it does.
It borders Kentucky.
It feels way more, it's weird, when you drive from Kentucky into Cincinnati, it doesn't feel like a Midwestern type of place.
No.
It feels more, it does, it feels more Southern than it does in some regards. Yeah,
it's, the people are very strange in Cincinnati, I will say that. Very strange. 28 to 38, 230 yards for Neusmeyer. This is the first time LSU has opened the season with a win since 2019. And I know from being married to a Cajun, my first marriage, my ex-wife is from Louisiana, so I've been to dozens of LSU games. When they lose, they're miserable down there, as they are in most of the southeastern part of the country in the SEC. But to start out 0-1 every year, at least they live in a world now. Well, they live in a world now where they're 1-0. But at least in previous seasons, and I'm feeling this now because my school lost last night. Like, you lose the opener, you're 0-1, and you're like, okay, well, you're 0-1, but there's 12 teams that make the playoffs. It's not the end of the world anymore.
I don't think Garrett Neusmeyer has a classically fat face
it
in the same vein
the
as
angle
a
angle that you get.
Well,
in that.
It's not like a Sam Darnold, Matt Stafford, Lance Berkman type thing where that's what their face is going to be for the rest of their life.
Yeah.
I feel like Garrett Neusmeyer, there's still a little bit of baby fat there. I don't think he's. I don't think it's not a bloated Sam Darnold face necessarily.
Well, Stafford's overcome that. Stafford's thinned out in his old age. Doesn't have quite the fat face that he used to. Darnold, absolutely fat face. Who's the other one you brought up? You brought up Darnold.
Lance Berkman.
Oh, Lance Berkman. Yeah, Lance Berkman's still chubby cheeks. Yep.
Now, I don't know. Stafford, yeah. He has a beard these days. I think that's why it might be fooling you or deceiving you. Yeah.
Maybe. Garrett Neusmeyer, in my eyes, fat face. And I don't care if it's baby fat or adult fat. Fat face, but he was able to overcome it, and that's why he gets acknowledged in this segment. Tommy Castellanos.
Acknowledge me!
We've talked about Alabama getting upset by Florida State from the Alabama perspective earlier in the Kalen DeBoer stick a fork in him, he's done. Tommy Castellanos was the quarterback who ran through the Alabama defense on Saturday for Florida State. He was talking trash as far back as June this summer. He was talking trash at ACC Media Days in July. As far back as in June. And keep in mind, Castellanos is a transfer from Boston College, so he's played in the ACC his whole career. He got sideways with Bill O'Brien at Boston College and decided to leave and go to Florida State. He said this back in June, quote, "I've dreamed," talking about the opener against Alabama, "I've dreamed of moments like this. I dreamed of playing against Alabama. They don't have Nick Saban to save them. I just don't see them stopping me," end quote. He went 9 of 14 for 152 yards. So he didn't throw the ball very much, but when he did, boy, chunk plays, averaging over 10 yards an attempt. And then he had 16 carries for 78 yards, including a scintillating rushing touchdown. And they won pretty handily. They were up 24-7 at one point. They won 31-17. Alabama got dominated by Florida State on Saturday.
Yeah, I did. They did. Tell me if this... So regarding the drama of Castellanos leaving BC, yeah. He had defended himself by saying, there's so many narratives saying, oh, he got benched or he quit, right? Nobody knows what happened and that, you know, behind closed doors and what Bill O'Brien said. So he pushed back against the narrative. And then Bill O'Brien, I think, started off, it sounded like he was trying to take the high road. Tell me if this sounds like Bill O'Brien. Just for one paragraph, he couldn't keep it together on the high road. He said, Tommy can think whatever he wants. Okay, it starts off a little bit passive-aggressive.
Oh, yeah.
We supported the hell out of Tommy. We coached Tommy. We taught Tommy. I wish him the best. We met with Grayson James. We told him the team needs you. Come back and compete and win your job back. It's called life. L-I-F-E. Oh, deal with adversity. He's fine. He's the starting quarterback at Florida State. It worked out well. I wish him the best.
Okay, when Bill O'Brien starts spelling words,
yeah,
he's agitated.
I wonder, though, too, because remember he did it with the Texans where he said capital T, capital E, yeah, capital A, capital M.
Yeah.
Here in this quote, it's capital L, capital I, capital F, capital E. I wonder if he actually said the capital in
he
those.
Did in the, he did in the team. He did.
Right.
Sure.
No, I know. I know. Yeah. So I wonder if he said it in this quote, but they didn't quite know how to handle it with the, with the quote without
this.
Making it confusing. Yeah.
Without adding.
You got to find the audio now.
Yeah. To answer your question, definitely sounds like Bill O'Brien, 100%. So there you go. Florida State, after going 2-10 last year. Florida State 1-0 with a win over Alabama. That's a big win for Mike Norvell, man. The head coach there. That's huge.
Boston, by the way, Boston College, they won 66-10 over Fordham now. So,
okay.
66-10 nonetheless.
Oh, yeah. B.O.B.'s got that offense clicking.
They didn't take Fordham lightly. Yeah.
No, they did not. They did not. I think Bill O'Brien was tailor-made to be coaching Boston College football. From Boston College, I've always thought Bill O'Brien, good college coach. I think he's got a shot. Lee Corso.
Acknowledge me.
We acknowledge Lee Corso because it was his final game on College Game Day on Saturday. It was pretty cool. You and I talked to Rob Stone last Thursday. Stoner's the coach of Big Noon Saturday on Fox. And he had foreshadowed for us that they were going to be doing some stuff to acknowledge Coach Corso, even though they were literally not just a competing network. They compete shows with each other. I mean, this is a battle for viewers. They not only did a mascot head thing on Fox, they actually simulcasted Lee Corso's farewell at the very end of game day.
Really?
Yeah. I was looking at my TV. Well, I was at a Boomer Jackson, Katie, actually, and I'm like, okay, there were different shows on these TVs. And I was talking to people, and I look up, I'm like, why is Lee Corso on all these TVs right now? And you could see on half of them, there was a little Fox logo in the upper right-hand corner.
Yeah.
So that's if you want a measurement of how legendary somebody is as a broadcaster,
yeah,
when the opposing network's show picks up the simulcast.
You know what, though? I like this. This is interesting, because if you think about it from Fox's perspective, they say, hey, we want to do the right thing and, you know, really just let Coach have his moment and all of that. And meanwhile, ESPN is like, probably, well, that's nice of you, but so you want to simulcast something that people might be turning away from your station to watch on our station.
Right.
But instead, they're going to stay on your station. Because ESPN would have had to give them permission to do that.
Yeah.
That's a dueling battle of, I think less than the honorable intentions that maybe it was presented as. That's hey, Fox, that's so nice that you would do that. Yeah, you're keeping them from switching over to ESPN to watch the Lee Corso stuff.
Oh, no, I'm not denying there's a business element to it. But, I mean, ESPN could have said no.
And right, I think they should have.
Yeah.
I think they should have, but they tried not to be petty.
Right.
They're like, no, be petty, all right? This is bloody business you're in here.
How about this? Lee Corso picked Ohio State over Texas on his mascot pick.
You know,
where he puts the mascot head on. So he picked Ohio State to beat Texas, which they did. He picked Florida State over Alabama. He got a lot of run for that. That was a big upset. Alabama was favored by 2 touchdowns in that game. Now, Lee Corso went to Florida State. So part of his handicap was, look, I went there, so how can I pick against the Seminoles? It was really funny, like people acting like Lee Corso, like knew, you know, like he had actual analysis on it. But we'll give him credit for that. I thought this was kind of fun, that all of the schools that Lee Corso either played at or coached at all won on Saturday.
Huh.
Yeah.
Wow.
FSU over Alabama, Maryland over FAU, Navy over VMI, Louisville over Eastern Kentucky, Northern Illinois over Holy Cross, and then Indiana beat Old Dominion.
I think that needs to be his job in retirement. It needs to be just every now and then going to one of those places and just showing up beforehand and being kind of a good luck talisman for those teams.
It's like a talisman. Yeah, yeah. He's like he's a rabbit's foot. He's a walking rabbit's foot. Coach Prime,
acknowledge me.
I appreciate Coach Prime and his team not covering on Friday night against Georgia Tech. That came in very handy. That's not why I'm acknowledging him. I'm acknowledging Coach Prime because of this answer we didn't get to last week, but it's really funny. He was asked by I believe they're one of the local reporters in the Denver area. What's been your biggest surprise in coaching games at CU?
Is there anything about Folsom, about this stadium, that surprised you, that you didn't expect?
Yeah. The smell of weed in the second quarter surprised the heck out of me. Like, every game, I'm like, dang. Like, it seems like it's like a light-up quarter. You know what I'm saying? Like, so is this the quarter that y'all chose? Like, I'm serious. It's a TV timeout. It never fails. And I'm like, wow. What's going on? Because, you know, I've never been high a day of my life. So that's kind of new to me.
That's a bolder essential, I guess.
Yeah, truly.
It's interesting that it happens in the second quarter. Yeah, I wonder why that is.
Yeah, I don't know. And I think Dion's trying to figure that out too.
He wasn't surprised that it smells like weed.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of places that smell like weed these days.
Yeah,
it's still shocking to us Gen Xers and Boomers. But there must be something going on. Why would they? I'm just impressed that they. Seemingly, they just withhold until the second quarter.
Yes, yeah. That's maybe they've been doing it in the parking lot the whole time, and they're they got to re.
That's true. It might be a late arriving crowd, so by the time all the smoke kind of accumulates and then wafts down towards the field,
arriving, or they get there on time, but they get their last hit in before they go in, and then they're just kind of taking a break for a quarter and like, all right, time to toke up again. You know, the high is wearing off. I don't know. I'm not a big weed smoker, so I don't know the dynamics of how long it takes for a high to wear off or whatever. I don't know.
I'll tell you what's freaking me out as an old man now, Sean, as a Gen Xer. This stuff. Look, I've experimented for medicinal purposes as things have changed legally and whatnot.
Sure.
This stuff's too strong, man. This is not, I don't mess with it at all. I do not mess with any of this stuff anymore because it's, what's the safe dose that I would enjoy? A third of a gummy? What the hell? No, it's too much. It's too strong. You got to back off a little bit, man.
I bought some when Amy and I drove through Colorado, I bought some of the edibles or whatever. And I like once every month and a half, I'll have half of one. Just to either you know, just ease up, just to relax or whatever. But I'm not, I'm not like an everyday person or anything.
I feel like it used to be, you know, you had to, it was a commitment to be a stoner.
Yeah.
For somebody that would, you know, if you were doing something in the morning or something, you were hardcore. And now I just fear that there are a lot of young people that are, they've kind of stumbled into that life.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not always the best strategy.
It's not at all.
Yeah. It's hard because, you know, with the hard drugs that you should never ever touch or try, there's the immediate death that is the risk, obviously, or your life completely falls apart. It's just when you grow up and you see kids that really never realize their potential in life because they're hardcore stoners. And I feel like there's a lot of kids just without even being committed to the cause are just stumbling into being hardcore stoners because stuff's just so strong and available.
That's the available is the big one. Yeah. Real quick, working at a power plant, people always need electricity. Very true. And if you're in any sort of business where people, where the whatever your product is does not discriminate on day of the week or on holidays, you are working today, and we appreciate you. All right, you can text in 713-572-4610. All right, Seth, Lopez had a take on Friday that I take great issue with. He knows this already. I've texted him about it. But I got to run this by you to see if this is take-a-mania worthy for Friday this week. So we're going to run it through the filter. We'll do that. Coming up next.
Yes.
All right, a lot of hardworking people up listening to us. Headed to work, service manager, maintenance for an apartment community. That is the Lord's work right there, man. Service manager, getting all those phone calls to fix garbage disposals and air conditioning and things
like that. Especially on Labor Day.
Yeah.
Because I'm guessing there's a lot of plumbing issues on Labor Day. Well, or maybe the day after, two after Labor Day. Because people, it's one of the holidays where you end up eating quite a good amount.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
Labor Day is an eating holiday. What are the eating holidays? I would say Thanksgiving, 4th of July, and Labor Day.
Memorial Day is a big one, too.
Oh, Memorial Day, too.
Memorial Day's
anytime where a lot of cookouts are involved or anything, and a lot more. People might say Christmas, but Christmas, maybe you have one big meal or something, but it's not an all-day affair of, you know, being out and at a picnic or a barbecue or whatever. Yeah.
Thanksgiving weekend's probably the biggest one. That's the one where you got all the leftovers. So it's
and it's also the stress of the approaching holidays too. That sometimes there's some stress eating involved.
Oh yeah. Good call.
Halloween's a rough one. That sneaks up on you because it's a week afterwards, and it's nothing but candy.
Yeah.
If you don't get rid of that candy the day after, you're hosed, man.
Truck driver rolling towards Kentucky, listening on the Odyssey app. We appreciate that. Oil field worker in Victoria, listening like every other day. Sir, try to step it up to every day, but we appreciate.
He's saying like every other day, like any other day of the week. He's listening.
Oh, like every other day. Oh, okay. Gotcha. All right. 713-572-4610. All right. So in the loop on Friday, there was a segment they were doing where Lopez was explaining to Reggie and Figgy why the golden age of Houston sports. And maybe I'm butchering the exact topic, but Lopez was explaining how 1975 through like 2000 was a better time and place in Houston sports than the one we're living in right now, which is pretty damn good. All three of the major teams are contenders right now. I think you can, with a straight face, put a Super Bowl, NBA title, or World Series case together, even though it doesn't feel that way offensively right now for the Astros. Like it or not, they are still one of the top six or seven teams on the odds board to win the World Series. So Lopez was kind of going through, and Figgy was kind of taken aback by that. Like, wow, really? It was that much better 1975 through 2000. So Lopez was explaining that you had a couple nice eras with the Oilers where they made the AFC title game a couple of times against the Steelers in the late 70s. Mm-hmm. You had the Warren Moon run and shoot era, which was a good, not great because they didn't win anything, but they won a lot of regular season games in the late 80s and early 90s. Explain that the Rockets won two championships and they went to the finals a couple other times in that period of time. Brought up U of H and Phi Slamma Jamma. And he brought up the Astros and talked about how the Astros, they didn't win a World Series in that era, but they did win the division in 1980 and made the postseason. Went to the limit with the Phillies, who went on to win the World Series. And then he talked about 1986. And he said, look, in 1986, the Astros came one 16-inning game in Game 6 away from, well, you know, I'm not going to explain. Here was Lopez explaining the 1986 Houston Astros in an assertion that I found a little bit offensive as a Red Sox fan back then.
1986, one play away from probably winning a World Series in 1986. And Sean Pendergast is saying, I agree with your overall take on 75 through 2000, but the one play away thing is what he might have issue with in terms of the 75 to 2000.
Mm-hmm. And then when we start
talking about the home run that spelled the difference in game six, that one play.
Yeah.
Because game seven was Mike Scott.
Yeah.
That's the one play I'm talking about.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Then Mike Scott was going to pitch game seven. They're still trying to figure out how to
hit
it.
Okay. So Lopez's assertion was that if things go a different kind of way in game six, that the Astros, game six of the NLCS, not game six of the World Series, that the Astros probably would have won the World Series. And I'm saying to myself, okay, they still would have had to win Game 7. To Lopez's point, Mike Scott was going to pitch Game 7. They certainly would have been favored to win Game 7 if I had to guess. Yeah. The Red Sox, they would have still had to beat the Red Sox in the World Series, a team that actually came within one play of beating the New York Mets in six games if Bill Buckner didn't let the ball roll through his legs.
Yeah.
So that's where I Lopez just sort of cavalierly asserting, like, well, if this one play goes differently, then they win the World Series.
Then they probably win, and then all of a sudden that also makes that part of the golden era, which okay, ifs and buts and candy and nuts and all of that. Like, that's one play to where we would have put you in the conversation to potentially win the World Series. Yeah. But it's also in an era where it's not like the Astros were just – they weren't attending the postseason every year at all. That was their one, that was their one postseason appearance from 1982 through 1997.
Yes.
You know, this golden era that Lopez is talking about.
Put the golden era part aside, because I don't necessarily disagree with him that there was a lot of good stuff that happened in Houston sports over that time. It's the assertion that if one play changes in Game 6 of the NLCS, that the Astros probably go on to win that series and another seven-game series.
Yeah.
Probably, I don't even know that they would have been favored against the Red Sox. And so I texted him about this, and his reply was, Mike Scott, Nolan Ryan. And that was his whole reply. And I said, okay, well, the Mets did get to Nolan Ryan for five earned runs in game two of that series. And the Red Sox did have Roger Clemens, who was the MVP and Cy Young winner on their team.
I just said, yeah, okay, Mike Scott, Nolan Ryan. It didn't get you through the NLCS.
Right.
I don't like Mike Scott, Nolan Ryan can't be your trump card that you pull out when you're talking about a team that lost a series in which they had Mike Scott and Nolan Ryan.
Point. Yes, that's
yeah,
my point.
It just doesn't.
The golden era stuff is off to the side. This is my point, which is
it's like you lost it. You just like you get a showdown in the Old West. And you got a Colt 45, but you get shot in the head.
Right.
And you're like, yeah, well, if I had to do it over again, Colt 45.
Okay, so you're with me on this.
Yes, okay. 100%.
Okay.
No, plus, no, but I disagree with the entire notion that somehow it was better then in terms of golden era or team success or what have you, because that was the Astros' lone postseason appearance. Now, it was harder to make the postseason back then, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah, it
but,
was.
But It was a lot harder. But, yeah, I don't – you had the Rockets championships.
Yep.
But it wasn't like the – no, I don't – I think the biggest thing that Lopez and other people who lived in Houston back then, the difference was that it was a much smaller city. I mean, like in 1985, the greater Houston area had 2.7 million people in it, whereas right now it's got 6.9 million people in it. It was still a very large city by where they ranked in American cities and what have you.
Yeah.
But I think it was more homegrown Houstonians, and it probably just had more of a small town vibe to a lot of the sports teams and their followers and everything.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I know at least with the football, you know, with the Oilers, like getting to the AFC title game was enough for them to pack the dome the night the team got back. They were just so excited about football back then. That's why, like, I understand his argument. It sounds like you have more of an issue with him categorizing 75 through 2000 as a golden era than you do my issue with the whole 86 Astros probably win the World Series take.
Yeah, I guess, and I can't say because I didn't live there, but just from listening to people tell stories about it and what have you, it was a different feel to it. But I think part of that is also how things have changed in society at large.
Yeah.
There wasn't social media.
Yeah.
Sports radio wasn't a thing until the 90s.
Yep.
It was more of a, you read about the team in the paper in the morning, you talk about it with your coworkers, and then you go to the game.
Yep.
And it was times were simpler then, Sean.
Yeah.
But that's in society at large, not just any one specific era of one sports city.
I moved here in 94, so I was here for the second of the two. I moved here October 94. So it was in between. I moved here in between the two Rocket Championships, and it was fun, man. It was really fun to be here. Anything where it goes back before I was living here, I'll just kind of take John's word for it on that. But I had a television and lived somewhere where they broadcasted the NLCS and the World Series that year. And I can tell you right now, there ain't no probably about anything with the Astros winning the 86 World Series if one play goes differently for them in Game 6 of the NLCS. Not Game 7, in Game 6. So they still got to win one more game and then win a best-of-seven series. I don't know what John's definition of probably is, if it's 50.1%. My definition of probably means like 80%. You're going to win that thing. And that does not fit that criteria for me. Okay, so this might show up again on Friday, this take. Especially because the listenership's a little down today. This might be in Take-A-Mania on Friday, Seth, just so you know. And John knows already. He's been warned.
If we're going to take those probablys, then we have to add the Rockets being the second-best team in basketball in the James Harden era for many of those seasons. And saying, okay, well, if Chris Paul doesn't tear his hamstring, then the Rockets probably win a championship that year. If we're going to start stacking probablys up to other probablys or maybes, then I still feel like the current era, just by virtue of all the Astros championships, there's just, it's hard to compete with that, man.
That's not helping, because I probably did say, hey, if Chris Paul doesn't pull his hamstring, they probably win the NBA championship. I probably said that at one point.
No, but if the I've got more of an issue with the golden era glory than you do. I do. I am jealous a little bit of people when they talk about the 70s and 80s in Houston. It just felt like there was very much of a almost like a pioneer spirit or something, or of like, man, we're a city on the rise.
Yeah, for
you
sure.
You still had, because the space program, I mean, that was, I think kids now and even like people my age and younger probably don't really appreciate how big a deal the space program was and just how much prestige it brought. I mean, astronauts were bigger than athletes and back in those days.
Yeah.
So the whole vibe of the city was very much one of like, oh yeah, we're setting the pace in a lot of things.
So my goal this segment was to play this micro take by Lopez and see if you agreed with my take on it. And in the end, it sounds like you disagree more with the Lopez's macro take on the golden era than my whole thing about probably winning a World Series. Okay. Don't know if I got my mission accomplished there. All right. Going into the 8 o'clock hour, one of the biggest debuts in college football this weekend wasn't even a player or a coach. How do we think this went on Fox Sports 1 and Fox Sports on Big Noon Saturday over the weekend? We'll have that for you coming up next.